The Doom Buggies podcast is sponsored by MEI Mouse Fan Travel. Get a no-obligation quote for any of your Disney travel needs at mousefantravel.com.
You're listening to the Doom Buggies podcast for the month of February 2023.
Welcome, podcast listeners. Keep your ears inside your headphones at all times and join me for this swinging wake.
Welcome, foolish mortals, to another episode of the Doom Buggies podcast. My name is Jeff Bam, and I am the founder of DoomBuggies.com and the host of the show, along with my co-host, Julia. Hey, Julia, how you doing?
Hey, Jeff, I'm doing good.
Excellent, excellent. Yeah, well, we're here for another month, another installment of Haunted Mansion-related merriment, right? So, or is it so merry? I'm going to report on a, briefly, on a panel discussion I went to last month.
Ooh.
Or this month, I suppose. And then we're going to talk about animation today. And you might be saying, like, what does animation have to do with the Haunted Mansion? Oh, you're going to find out. You're going to find out. Yes, a lot. You have that to look forward to. I do want to say thank you to our sponsor for this episode, Mouse Fan Travel. Anytime you want to go out, take a Disney vacation, maybe a Disney cruise, maybe an Adventure by Disney trip around the world, anything Disney, they got you covered, right? So if you, and I mean, you have no risk, you can go there, get a quote, find out, you know, what they can do for you. I have used Mouse Fan Travel personally before they were even a sponsor, so I can vouch for them. Good company. So if you're going to take a Disney trip, get no obligation quote at mousefantravel.com. Okay, so Julia, let's talk a little tea. It's tea time.
Grim-grinning ghosts come out to socialize.
This month, we are going to talk about Disney animation. So I thought we would start with, you know, reminding people of the darker side of Disney animation. Because, of course, you know, the first thing you think when you think Disney animation, or at least up until recent controversies have arisen, but typically you think Disney animation, family friendly. I don't even have to think about it if I have kids. I can turn on Disney and plop them in front of the TV, and whatever it is, it'll be fine, right? Well,
right.
Here we are to disabuse you of that notion. we're going to talk about Disney animation a little bit on the darker side. So I think we'll start, Julia. I'm going to just put you on the spot. Mm-hmm. I want to know your best example of dark Disney animation.
Well, when you did originally pitch this idea to me, the first thing that came to my head was, of course, Skeleton Dance, which I think is a lot of people's favorite thing, and got a lot of attention last year through merchandise and whatnot. But it's not what I'm going to talk about today.
Okay.
I am going to talk about the 1985 release of The Black Cauldron.
Okay.
Which is
somewhat controversial.
Yes, and it is seldom anybody's favorite.
And yet here you are. So
here I am.
I think now you have seen The Dark Cauldron.
Yes, I have seen The Black Cauldron.
The Black Cauldron.
Yes.
Okay, so go on. Talk to us about why this remains with you to this day as a great example of dark Disney.
I did not see this movie when it originally came out. I was not quite born yet, but I have seen it. Since it is not one that I grew up with, because like I said, it was basically a flop at the theater. So it's not super well known unless you're like really into that type of animation, which I'm sure a lot of our listeners are. But it is Disney Animation's 25th feature film. And it was loosely based on the first two books in the Chronicles of Prydain series written by Lloyd Alexander. And I have heard that really is very loosely based. So if you're a huge fan of those books, this movie is probably not going to do it for you.
Well, as most Disney animation that's based on some type of written fiction, typically very, very loosely based.
Right. But like you, to your point before, when you were like, oh, it's Disney, let me just plop my kid down in front of it because everything's going to be okay. This actually was the first Disney film to receive a PG rating.
I remember that.
Mm-hmm. And it was supposed to be released in 1984, but because of the climactic scenes, Jeffrey Katzenberg ordered a a re-edit of the film because he deemed it too disturbing for children. So I'm really curious, like, what happened in those scenes that was too disturbing for children? And I also think it's interesting. Do you remember that Tim Burton exhibit at
Blackmon? Yes.
In that exhibit, there was a section that they kind of talked about his animation career because he worked for Disney when he was first starting out. And he actually worked as a concept artist on this film. And they do have some examples of his work. And I would be just so interested to see an entire completed version of that that film that he worked on with his designs. That would be really cool.
That would be fascinating, wouldn't it?
And so last year they released the full version of Muppets Christmas Carol on Disney Plus that has not been edited because also Jeffrey Katzenberg decided that there was a song in that movie that was too boring for children. He had some interesting opinions, that Jeffrey Katzenberg.
I would say mostly successful and right opinions, but you're right. He had some strong opinions about what was going to be Disney.
Yes. So I would like them to, I hope they have like the original version of this film somewhere. I want to see it.
You mean the Black Cauldron?
Yeah. Of the Black Cauldron. I want to see it. And I think there would be an audience for that.
Yeah. Well, of course, these days there's an audience for everything.
There
I agree.
Is. Yeah. And I think there is a home for it on Disney Plus. Just throw it in the extras like they did. Don't make my mistake. The full version of Muppets Christmas Carol is in the extras section.
Yeah. Yeah.
Find it there. I think that they could do that quite easily. And I want to see it.
Okay. I agree with you. So that's actually a good example. You know, I think that's, I'm trying to think, with the exception of this film that I'm going to talk about mostly, I think that might be the only Disney feature that is all basically that you could call a movie of. I mean, there are some suspense movies like Rescuers or kind of detective dramas, you know, and some of those kind of things have a lot of suspense in them, but I would call that pretty much the darkest overall Disney
and
feature.
Like the Horn King, I think is his name. He is very Chernabog-ish, who is just such a cool character. Like, I think that they could turn this movie into like a cult classic if they did that.
Yeah. Well, it kind of is a cult classic in a sense already. So I'll talk to you. You know, you bring up a couple points that are actually good points I want to kind of reflect on. So you talk about Chernabog, which kind of leads us to points to the idea of there's a lot of darkness in Disney films scattered throughout the whole collection, right? So Chernabog, of course, part of Fantasia, which has, you know, some very light moments, some abstract moments. This, of course, very dark and light tale of, you know, Ave Maria and Nine-Eyed Mountain.
So honestly, something for everybody in Fantasia.
Yeah, Fantasia covers all the bases. But when you look back at even just the recent past couple decades of Disney animated film history, if we go back to The Lion King, like, you know, that's a film that most parents will throw their kids in front of in a daycare, right? It still has an homage to a Nazi propaganda film in Be Prepared. Like, which is, if you take that and slice it out of that film, it's a very dark moment, as is the murder of Mufasa. Like, there's some darkness. Like, in order to get, and Walt Disney himself said, like, in order to have, you know, we're not going to shy away from drama. And in order to have the light side, you have to have the dramatic side to contrast it with. Of course, Friends on the Other Side from Princess and the Frog. I would say Dr. Facilier is a pretty dark villain.
I mean, not only that, when you watch Hunchback of Notre Dame, my goodness, Frollo is possibly one of the scariest villains of all time.
And the story, Hunchback of Notre Dame, which I would say that Disney film is actually, despite being like sanitized a little bit, but the storyline is actually closer to the fictional, I mean, the original fiction than most of their Disney adaptations are. So, and you know, that's considered a horror film in general, because of the well, both because of the creature and the question that's raised, the whole question that the film starts and ends with: what makes a monster and what makes a man, right? So there are horror elements all throughout the history of Walt Disney Animation. I would kind of say, I do want to say, so when The Skeleton Dance came out, you mentioned thinking of that right away, ostensibly because it's skeletons in a graveyard dancing around. And to your point, I do believe it was controversial when it came out. I think mm-hmm. some theaters were a little bit antsy.
They're like, we want Mickey Mouse.
About showing. Yeah, I'm not certain. I feel like there was some commentary on the fact that it was skeletons, but mostly mm-hmm. I think they were saying, why did you choose this instead of Mickey Mouse? But I don't know. Like, it's not as a film goes, mm-hmm. it's. The music is not super scary. The skeletons are having a great time. Like, there's not a lot of darkness itself to that. But the Disney shorts did get pretty dark. Mickey and the Haunted House, which again did have controversy with the theaters. You know, they thought it was a little too grim in some places. Was kind of a horror film in a sense. Like, it had Mickey Mouse being. I guess the monster is trying to kill him. I try to remember. It's been so long since I've seen Mickey in the Haunted House. And of course, the Mad Doctor, you know. So Mickey Mouse also had his run-ins with kind of dark characters and villains. Murderous, like horror style. I would say, I think still to this day, the darkest Disney animated film is Snow White. Because mm-hmm. Snow White was intended to be immense drama from light to dark, like I said, Walt Disney's plan, right? And mm-hmm. and he knew, like, you have to emphasize the light, which is Snow White, that more innocent than a human could be, and the dark, which is the evil queen, which is more evil than a human could be, right? And so there's murder in there. There's horror with Snow White's fleeing through the forest. There's a lot of scary stuff in Snow White. I wouldn't call it a horror film, of course, although some lists, you know, just to be a little contrarian and with some honesty to it, have come out and said, like, oh, yeah, we can include Snow White in our list of greatest horror films ever. Right. So it is a dark.
It's intense. It could be Disney. Intense.
Yeah.
For
it
kids.
Is a dark Disney animation film. And I kind of also bring that up because being in the Bay Area, we have access to a really great exhibit of concept art and mm-hmm. history of the Snow White film. Because it was Walt Disney's first feature-length animation, the Walt Disney Family Museum up here in the Presidio in San Francisco has a significant exhibit dedicated to Snow White in its permanent mm-hmm. collection. So if you walk through the galleries up where they start talking about Walt Disney's animation, there's a small mm-hmm. exhibit of art from the skeleton dance, but there's mm-hmm. a big wall full of artwork and concept art and sketches and animation cells and then publicity materials all based on Snow White and a whole cabinet dedicated to the Evil Queen and the transformation mm-hmm. and the dark characters. So Snow White, does get a good, good representation in the Walt Disney Family Museum.
And Jeff, when we did the Happiest Haunts tour last Halloween season at the Walt Disney Family Museum, they spent a lot of time in front of those couple of cases with all of that character art and everything, and really dug deep into kind of the history of Snow White.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. So animation, the darker side of animation and Disney is not hard to find at all.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you want to share any of your thoughts about your favorite scenes of dark Disney animation that we've perhaps skipped over, we'd be glad to revisit this in a future episode. Just email mm-hmm. us at comments@doombuggies.com. And we'd love to hear what you have to say.
From regions beyond.
All right, Julia. So let's talk a little bit of news today. What, you got any news? I have some news.
I do. So you do. Go ahead. You go first.
Okay. Well, let's just start the news with the most obvious Haunted Mansion news, which is that it has been called the Haunted Mansion holiday this year forever. Like for, you know, a very extended period of time, the Haunted Mansion was the Haunted Mansion holiday. And it finally only closed down last week, you know, from the Haunted Mansion holiday to start its transformation back.
There is actually no reopening date announced yet, as far as I can tell. But it usually takes at least a couple of weeks, doesn't it?
Yeah, it usually doesn't take too super long to take it down. I think mm-hmm. it's sometimes is, probably 2 weeks, maybe. I don't know if it's been as little as a week, probably 2 weeks. Okay. It usually takes three or four weeks to put it in there. Yeah. This is going to be pretty much the longest Haunted Mansion has ever stayed, Haunted Mansion holiday. This is the better part of 5 months, at least 4.5 months, which is a ginormous section of the Haunted Mansion's operating season for the past 12 months. It's counting takedown.
Love it or hate it.
Counting setup and takedown. It's half of the year. So it's interesting.
It is significant, but it is also interesting. Like they can within those time windows when they're like setting it up or taking it down, they can make improvements in those times too, which is usually when they try and schedule that.
Is it? I know they have before. So yeah,
I don't know.
I presume. Well, I mean,
maybe you can I'm making that up.
I don't know if you are or not. I mean, it's almost,
it would make sense
without,
to me.
It almost goes without saying. Yeah. So, all right. Okay. Do you have any other news here?
Well, speaking of making improvements, I believe when they opened Haunted Mansion Holiday, there was an audio animatronic that was missing and has been missing since for the run of Haunted Mansion Holiday. Do you know who that is, Jeff? Did
well,
you notice?
Well, you gave me a heads up, so.
Did you know before I told you?
I am trying to remember if I noticed that. I may not have even really looked over in that direction. Although, to be fair, during the passing of that scene, I am usually unsuccessfully preparing my camera to try to capture a photograph of a pop-up ghost that comes up from behind a tombstone that's on the other side of
they
the track.
They are so hard.
Yeah, it's very hard to capture. I haven't successfully yet done that. So, but why don't you tell us what you're going to say?
So he's actually the inspiration for our tea party segment.
That's right.
The mummy. The mummy's been gone, who may or may not be named Prince Amenmos.
Spell it, please.
It is A-M-E-N-M-O-S-E.
Amenmos. Yeah, interesting. And where does that name come from?
So the first time I saw this name, it was announced on WDWNT.com when the figurine was released, let's see, several months ago in September.
So they're saying that, is it on the box or something? We don't know for sure. Yeah, I'm curious about that. I don't have any, you know, I know it wasn't originally when they made the Haunted Mansion, they didn't name all these characters in the graveyard. Some of them they did, the singing busts, but they didn't, as far as I know, name the mummy. So I'm curious, you know, it's interesting. I am the Doom Buggies guy, but I am
where
not,
does this name come from?
Not aware of where this came from, because a lot of, you know, and there is a history of marketing, trying to title these characters in the Haunted Mansion and with, mm-hmm. with more or less, success. The fans actually, or the, you know, the Walt Disney World cast members actually named the hitchhiking ghosts and in their little stories they wrote about the Haunted Mansion. And those names, in the early days of the internet became so popular that Disney kind of adopted them. So the hitchhiking ghost names actually were fan derived. I don't know that, when marketing gets involved with, like the whole Master Gracie controversy for a while there, they called, the changing portrait Master Gracie in the Haunted Mansion that's up above the fireplace. And then I do believe Imagineering even came in and said, I don't recall this exactly, but I believe they actually on the record, some Imagineers said, well, that's not the, you know, there's no, that's not Master Gracie. So it's interesting, right? How this all works together and all the various parts of Disney try not to step on each other's feet a little bit. So I'm curious about the origin of the name of the mummy, but be that as it may, okay, the mummy's gone.
The mummy's been gone for a while. And we, so that old man with the hearing horn has been listening to even less with his horn.
We can presume something is being improved or replaced in parts. So, you know, there's a surprisingly large amount of mechanical parts in those things. So we're going to talk about this in a few minutes, actually, the whole animation theme carrying through. But that is an audio animatronic. I'm trying to remember does the mummy make motions? It makes,
I think, a little
some
bit.
Type of motion, right? So I'm trying to remember all of
like
the
maybe
audio.
Maybe just raises his tea.
Something like that. Yeah, I'm trying to remember all the audio animatronics in the graveyard, because when they announced the Haunted Mansion, all through the land, all these press releases went out talking about Disney's new audio animatronic technology, right? Which was made famous in Pirates of the Caribbean, which was developed largely through the World's Fair. We'll talk about all this in a moment. But, well, not the World's Fair. The enhancements to Mr. Lincoln's exhibit, which was done ostensibly for the World's Fair. And so carrying that through to the Haunted Mansion, although the animatronics in the Haunted Mansion appear to be fairly simplistic. Although just recently at Van Eaton, and I can't remember the total that it sold for, but one of the highest selling Haunted Mansion props that went up for auction was a disc, cardboard disc that was used, I believe, to animate just the L on the tree in the graveyard. So a side character, to be generous.
Right.
but this disc, I think it was like the master to make the rubber disc, or however they used to work audio animatronics, using basically discs with notches to tell the mechanic, you know, that would spin. And then it's kind of like a music box, you know, when certain elements would be activated, certain motions would occur on the animatronics. And they were extraordinarily complex. And you can tell by looking at this, if you go to Van Neaton, I think it's vegalleries.com, you can actually probably still look this up in the last Disneyland auction they had if you want to take a look at this thing. Just a big circle. But you can see all the little marks and notches that represent the animation for this one little L that sat probably with another L or a raven or cats or something up in the background of the graveyard. So all of that to say, whether they look very extraordinarily sophisticated like the auctioneer animatronic, or whether they are basically sitting still and, you know, flopping their wings and moving their head, audio animatronics are fairly sophisticated animated creations, right? Okay, well, thanks, Julia, for sharing that news. I'm going to carry on some news. Actually, this is going to be a review of an event I attended on right around the New Year's on January 3rd, or when was it? No, January 6th, I think, over at the Gallery Nucleus in Alhambra, so out a little bit north of Disneyland. There is a gallery. It's a pretty good, it's a fun gallery if you are looking for kind of alternative Disney art or that kind of thing. It's not really a traditional animation gallery. It's more for kind of underground art, or, you know, some, they do a lot of animation history talks and things, mostly around book releases. So when Disney or Star Wars or Marvel, when they have their art of the production books come out, often Gallery Nucleus will have a panel discussion with some of the filmmakers, and you can go and get a book signed and listen to them talk. Well, I did that on January 6th about Guillermo del Toro's Pinocchio film. And so I will tell you, when they announced this was coming, they announced about a week before tickets were going to go on sale, that this event was going to happen. And the panel was going to be Mark Gustafson, who's the director of the film, Guy Davis, who's the production designer, Grizz Grimley, who is a famous book illustrator who kind of was the genesis of Pinocchio. We'll talk about that in a second. And of course, producer and creator Guillermo del Toro. So when they announced this, I knew this was going to be a hard ticket to get, right? So they were releasing it through Eventbrite. I set an alarm. I got ready. Tickets went, there's 130 tickets, right? 130 seats in this gallery, and you could buy two tickets. So for the most part, 60 to 70 or probably-ish slots, right? So the second they went on sale, I clicked on it, and it, you know, it said, how many do you want? So I clicked on two, and then it said, your tickets are no longer available. Try again, right? Literally within 10 seconds. So I kept trying. It got to be, I think it was, I don't remember if it was noon or something like that. I think it got to be 12:02. It kept on saying, you know, it would mostly just say no tickets are available. No tickets are available. But the Eventbrite link was still open. Like if you went to the page for the event, it said click here to get tickets. And so you'd click there and it would go, and then it would ask you how many, and you'd choose, and it would say no, either tickets are no longer available, or it would look for those seats and then say, oh, those tickets are no longer available. So I tried this over and over. Usually it would just give me an error, no tickets are available, no tickets are available. But I kept my eye on that thing saying that the link is still open, right? And then I guess you know what happened, so I can cut the story short. The long and short of it is, within it was almost 15 minutes after they went on sale. It might have been 11 minutes after they went on sale, and the link went through for me. So I bought two tickets and it went through. It was kind of like a miracle. Like it had been like ditching my tickets. And it was saying things like the quantity of tickets you want are no longer available, like a variety of error messages. And I got it, right? I got the tickets. Yeah. And it was only a couple minutes after that that finally the link button disappeared. So I think their architecture was just not set up for the amount of requests, and it was just ditching requests. Like rather than crashing, it would just kind of ditch the requests, right? So I had the very good fortune at the time to get these two tickets. And they were not really expensive. They were just placeholder tickets because when you got to the gallery, you could trade them back in to get in, but also for that value towards merchandise. So like, basically it was a placeholder ticket, right? So I got to do that. I got the tickets, went to the gallery on the day. They sold us the books. The books were $60. So with my $10 off, it was $50. The Big Art of Book. It's a beautiful book. So if you liked Guillermo del Toro's Pinocchio, which we should back up a minute and even mention what that is, if you're kind of out there saying like, what are you even talking about? Guillermo del Toro, famous movie director of dark type fantasies. He created a version of Pinocchio, which came out on Netflix. They did release it in theaters for a couple weeks also, but it was a direct release to Netflix. It was a Netflix film. And to wide acclaim, right? It has become widely acclaimed. I think it just win Golden Globes, I think. I'm not sure. We should look into that. Maybe you can Google that for a second. But so that film came out late last year for the holiday season. It's kind of a dark fantasy. We'll talk about that in a minute. But this was the panel to go along with the release of the Art of Book, right, at Gallery Nucleus. So that's where I was. After we sat down, and it turned out that they actually also added an animator to the panel, Nicholas D'Agostino, who had worked on animating the stop motion puppets in Pinocchio, was there talking about his art. And I got in there and listened to him talk a little bit. And then they came out and announced Guillermo del Toro is not feeling well, and he's not going to be coming to the talk. And yeah, there was palpable discontent in the air, although people were respectfully like, okay, well, here we all are with our books. And they're still going to be the director, the producer, and Grizz Grimley, one of the leading character designers here. So, you know, let's stay and see what they have to say. And to be fair, it was a fun and informative exhibition. Would I have driven all the way up there from San Jose, all the way down there from San Jose, had I known Guillermo del Toro was not going to be there? Possibly not, right? But I'm still glad that I did. And I still, the collector in me, so from that angle, I still got the book signed by the director, the production designer, one of the leading character artists, and an animator, right? So it still is a cool collectible thing. And the little bonus is they gave us all posters from Netflix, which were mini, like, you know, 12 by 18 mini posters, and ostensibly so we could get them signed by, you know, everyone there. But Guillermo was not there. So they said, listen, if you get them signed by everyone and then put them back in the box, we're going to ship these all to Guillermo del Toro. And then we will call you all when they come back and you can come pick up your poster signed by Guillermo del Toro. So, and it just turns out yesterday, actually, they sent the email saying Guillermo del Toro has signed. So starting next week, we're going to be able to go down there. You know, don't rush down there. If you didn't buy a ticket, they're going to compare the ticket names with who picks them up. But we're going to all be able to go down and get our poster picked up. Well, signed by Guillermo del Toro. So at least
perfect. You have a trip planned. So
I do have a trip planned coming up. So hopefully I'll be able to work that out. So, but let's talk
and
first.
Just to follow up, it did win Best Motion Picture Animated at the Golden Globes.
Yeah, that's what I thought. So it's on its way. We'll see if what it does with the Academy Awards. It will be an interesting battle between Pinocchio and Strange Worlds and whatever else
will
is
it,
out there.
I have a feeling it'll win.
Pinocchio,
yeah.
Ah, interesting prediction. Okay. So, although it does have, like we're saying, it does have momentum, right? So, anyway, a couple interesting things, takeaways from this I will throw out there. It was interesting to hear Guy Davis kind of give the timeline of this movie. So, Guillermo del Toro has said, he wasn't there, but he has said, like, the two films that made me who I am are Frankenstein and Pinocchio. And they're both kind of creator, father-son, and creator stories, right? And so he's wanted to do kind of his own Pinocchio forever, right? And so at least more than two decades ago, I don't remember when Grizz Grimley released Pinocchio, but he created his own version of Pinocchio also, which was a darker kind of take on the story. And Guillermo saw that and he said, that is my Pinocchio. Like, that character that you designed for this book, that's what I want Pinocchio to look like. So Grizz and Guillermo have been kind of collaborating on this for many years. It had a number of fits and starts somewhere around. So that was around the turn of the 21st century, somewhere around 2010, maybe 2009 or so. They kind of rebooted it and brought in. I think that's when Guy Davis, who's the production designer, kind of got pulled in. He was a comic book artist. He's worked with Guillermo on character design and production for lots of his films. And Guillermo kind of pulled him into it. Then they kind of moved on to other things again. And then again in 2018, I think they rebooted it again, right? And that's what we have right here. So Guy Davis kind of laid that out and talked about how integral Grizz Grimley was to the whole situation. Grizz was there and he talked about kind of being inspired by the character and how he developed his own version of Pinocchio. And then the director, Mark Gustafson, was there and he talked more about the themes of Geppetto and fatherhood and, again, tying in like the history of Frankenstein and how it's very similar to Geppetto creating Pinocchio, Frankenstein creating the monster, and what they were both trying to do versus what actually happened. And Pinocchio being 100% innocent character is associated with the complexity of Geppetto. And Guy Davis even said, yeah, the movie should really be called Geppetto, but no one would go see it if we called it Geppetto. So, you know, it's Pinocchio because it's the story of this wooden boy. But, you know, so having been able to see it at the, or being able to see the exhibit and all the concept art, a lot of the concept art on the wall, I believe, is reprinted in the book. But one thing you just couldn't be able to see was the stop motion puppets. And there's also been an exhibit in New York, I think at the Museum of Modern Art. I don't remember exactly. I think, and even in LA, although I don't know, all these exhibits might be closing up now, but there have been a number of exhibits, showing the stop motion puppets. And then also in Nucleus here, they had a few of the stop motion puppets. You could see Jiminy Cricket, Pinocchio, Geppetto, and then a few of the other characters. And you could really get there and just stare, right? At these stop motion puppets, which is always something amazing to do. If you're ever able to go to an exhibit of stop motion puppetry and just look at the models,
it's so cool.
It's always amazing to see how small they can make the details because, you know, to be shown on a large screen and be realistic, these things have to be pretty amazingly detailed, and they are, right? So it's just incredible. So I don't really need to say much more about the exhibit. Some people were, of course, it was funny when I got there. I got to the gallery and I thought, oh, are they having us line up in back? You know, because behind it, there was this line of people. And then I recognized they had bunches of things in their hands and it was the autograph hounds there to meet Guillermo. So they were waiting for Guillermo. And so I went around front and got my seat. And then finally they announced he wasn't going to be coming. So kind of a bummer, but, maybe I'll be able to have a chance to. I have been able to meet Guillermo del Toro before at a different signing, and he was kind enough to, you know, I mean, because he wrote the, you might recall, he wrote the, a blurb for my book. He wrote a very generous blurb for my book. So he, you know, we know each other professionally, you could say. So, you know, hopefully someday I'll have a chance to have another conversation with him. But it was a great exhibit. Pinocchio, if you haven't seen it yet, check it out. It's on Netflix. And yeah, that's my review.
Did you forget your death certificate? Download your own at doombuggies.com.
From author Jeff Baham, founder of doombuggies.com. The unauthorized story of Walt Disney's Haunted Mansion, the number one Amazon bestseller that acclaimed director Guillermo del Toro has called enchanting and mesmerizing. Read insider accounts of creative clashes and never-before-told stories about the history of the greatest haunted attraction ever built. Dwarfandgiant.com raves that this book is full of arcane knowledge. The unauthorized story of Walt Disney's Haunted Mansion. Available now from Amazon.com or visit doombuggies.com/book and order your copy today.
All right, Julia. So now for our creature feature presentation. Let's talk a little bit more about the history and role of animation in the Haunted Mansion. So you mentioned
bring it on.
You mentioned the Haunted Mansion holiday overlay in place at the Haunted Mansion. And of course, we all know that is a stop motion animation classic that the Tim Burton's The Nightmare Before Christmas, that is in the Haunted Mansion. So there is an overlay of animation on top of the Haunted Mansion. And in this overlay, we can see very obvious animation, like they've added animation to the stretching gallery. So you can look up and see some literal digital animation happen up in top of the, up in top of the stretching room when you stretch. The changing portraits animate during Haunted Mansion holidays. So there's more literal animation happening in there. And then the characters, of course, are based on the stop motion animation puppets. Most notably, Jack Skellington with Zero. He's the hero animatronic, right? He replaces the grave the caretaker, cemetery caretaker, right? And he is quite an advanced audio animatronic figure up there. Doing his thing, right? So, but the history of animation goes back further than that, way back before the Haunted Mansion, you know, even to the beginning of kind of Disneyland, right? So, Walt's always tried to represent characters in automaton form, like robotic formats in his characters so that they never tire, they never go on break, they never stop acting for the guests, right? And so, the Haunted Mansion, like I mentioned, capitalized on that, especially in the early marketing. Like they said, there's going to be all these amazing ghosts, all these special effects and audio animatronic characters, which there are. Like I mentioned, like even the owl, the audio animatronic owl has this giant disc of actions just to create this one little beast that moves around and does his blinking, winking and flapping. Right. So, where does this all come from, right? So I just thought we'd talk for a moment, not going to belabor the point, but I'd talk a little bit about how Walt Disney and the Imagineers kind of developed the art of audio animatronic animation. So audio animatronics, which I think is a trademark of Walt Disney Imagineering, it actually, most people think it means, well, there's also sound and then there's motion, so it's audio animatronics. But it really refers to how they first originally animated the things using audio tracks, like audio tape and audio cues was what triggered the animation. So that's where the term audio animatronics came from. And if you know a little bit of the history of the Walt Disney Company, Walt Disney famously went on a trip to Europe and they visited Paris, and Walt saw these little toys you could wind up, notably this little bird cage, which you could wind up and there'd be a little bird in there that would do a little chirping and action. And then he brought this back, and you can see it in a variety of places. I don't know if it's, is it in the archives exhibit somewhere? Have you seen this thing before? I know I've seen it on videos and things, but yeah. this little French mechanical bird thing.
Don't remember seeing it like in person, but you're right, it's definitely on video.
Yeah, and the thing about this thing, which I'll just tell you, so I'm kind of a Disney nerd, so like for instance,
Disney nerd.
Yeah, I Walt Disney famously also went to the Chicago Railroad Fair in 1948 and 49 to kind of see how they were using the railroad as the centerpiece of attractions, which was a large influence into Disneyland. So I bought a banner from the Chicago Railroad Fair. Well,
When you bought that. Yeah, that
was I was with you, right?
Yeah. Fascinating. Yeah.
So I also went out and thought, I want to kind of see one of these things in person, these bird things. So you can still find these French. So they're made in France around, I'm trying to remember when they were popular. I think from like the turn of the century through the 30s and 40s, maybe it was the sweet spot of when they sold these things. But like even the exact one that Walt Disney bought, you can still find them available through auction houses, eBay, online, you know, places. And usually, I don't know, they sell from anywhere from, I don't know, maybe $200 to maybe $1,000, right? Depending on the quality and everything. I found one that wasn't too expensive. It wasn't in super shape, but it looked okay. But the cool thing is, and you never know what's going to actually happen when you wind it up, right? Because they can say it works, but what does that mean? I have to tell you, I brought this thing home. It's like 100 years old. I wound it up, set it on the ground, and this little bird sounds exactly like a real bird. It's the most incredible. Aww. Like, you can totally imagine Walt Disney seeing that in a sitting up on the shelf in a store or hanging, mm-hmm. and saying, like, this is That's what amazing. I want to do. Yeah. Yeah, this is what I want to do. Right. So I have one of those in my collection. You can still get them. Like I said, they're around as antiques, but Walt Disney had one. Right. And so a lot of people consider that one of the defining moments of his decision to, like, create robotic actors and creatures for his attractions. And so, mm-hmm. In the early '50s, there's an Imagineer, they weren't Imagineers, a couple people working for Walt Disney Productions, Roger Brogy and Walter Rogers. They would become Imagineers, but Walt said, like, I want you to figure out how to make these, like, robots. Cause it was, Rogers was a sculptor and Brogy was kind of a machinist. He worked in the machine shop, and he said, mm-hmm. okay, so you two are the ones, like, you're going to come up with a robot for me. So there was this, so they hired, Buddy Ebsen, because it was Walt Disney. He could get, you know, whoever he wanted. So they said, let's get an actor dancer in here. So he came in and filmed some stuff. They tried to make this, kind of little robot thing start acting like a person, right? So that was the earliest with, I would say, limited success, but that was the first attempts to try to create robots that would do actual human looking projects. Of course, the next phase of that, I mean, in between there, Disneyland opened, and there were, you know, there was already an industry of dark rides which had robotic characters in it. Like, it's not like Walt Disney was the first person to ever think, you know, let's have robotic characters in our rides. There was all kinds of stuff already out in the world. So Disneyland had its fair share of characters in the attractions. But, you know, Walt was looking for something to replace actors, right? And none of these things would replace actors. So, of course, finally the World's Fair came up. And, you know, Bob Gurr, who we talk about from the Haunted Mansion perspective, mostly for creating the audio or the Doom Buggies, right? The Omnimover system. You know, he also is critically important from a perspective to Imagineering of finding a way to really make these believable audio animatronic humans, because mm-hmm. he is the one, at least according to himself, because he tells the story a lot, but it seems fairly accurate. He decided to, he kind of figured out, well, we need something super light. And he was interested in airfare or lightness of mechanics, because he was interested in gliding and airplanes and air travel and that kind of thing. So what he knew about gliders and such is that, well, you could use aluminum, and depending on how you you know, kind of put these things together, you can have strength but lightness, you know, kind of like bird bones. Like, we can create this character that doesn't have to be these thick, giant, heavy metal pieces, you know. And so, thanks to Bob Gurr and the Great Moments with Mr. Lincoln exhibit for the World's Fair, he came up with this character, audio animatronic character, that did a lot of lifelike motions with its arms and hands. It could, you know, stand and sit. It could, you know, its face even had lots of very expressive features. And really, that's the beginning of audio animatronics as we know them at Disneyland currently today, right? And so, mm-hmm. and that's what Disneyland, when they kept talking about audio animatronics in their press releases and such for the Haunted Mansion, that's what they were trying to draw people's attention to. Now, mm-hmm. like I said, the Haunted Mansion itself has fairly limited amount of extensive audio animatronic material. I mean, no, I shouldn't say it that way. There is extensive use of audio animatronics in there. It doesn't have that hero, like, auctioneer figure. Jack Skellington during the Haunted Mansion holiday does kind of take that place. But the caretaker that's in his position, usually, he mostly just sits and turns and looks, and his knees buckle. You know, he has very limited motion to his character. But it goes along with what's happening there, because he's supposed to be frozen in place, right, from kind of shock and awe. So the actual Haunted Mansion standard attraction doesn't have that show-stopping auto-animatronic figure, but it does have audio-animatronics extensively throughout the graveyard and the ballroom scene. So, you know, this has just kind of been an overview of how animation also has lent itself to the creation and development of the Haunted Mansion. You know, you could go back and say, before the Haunted Mansion or Disneyland or even themed entertainment was a big deal, the idea of animating and having an illusion of life has always been kind of integral to all live entertainment. Even going back to like Madame Tussauds when it first opened and wax museum exhibits, they would have wax sculptures that they would put, you know, little heartbeats into so that they would look like they were breathing and moving. Like the idea of animating life is not original to Walt Disney, or, you know, it goes back all the way to the history of themed entertainment, but specifically Disney. And like we've been mentioning, the Imagineers. I will say, you know, I keep talking about how it's been in the press releases and things. Well, Disney was trying to kind of capitalize on the mystique of Walt Disney Imagineering in the 60s. And then there was a reporter. I just want to read this one quote. I have it on doombuggies.com. And let me see if I can find it here. There's a quote by a writer who had a syndicated newspaper column. And okay, November 1965. The reporter's name was Armand Urchard. And he said, he wrote in there, here it is. He wrote, "A status symbol today in conversations with the hippest of the inset or with the suavest of high society is the ability to pronounce audio animatronics. And if you'd like to get another 5 points in the status symbol set, to explain audio animatronics." So continuing on, he says, "Do you want to be in the inn with this group? You won't find the answers in the smoky cocktail bars around New York's Magazine and Madison Avenue Row. Go from Manhattan to Glendale, California, and to a plain looking set of factory buildings, which fly the banner of WED Enterprises." So like in the late '60s, you know, Imagineers did have their groupies, kind of, in a sense. Let's see. Armand, he says, okay, so further in the article, he says, "The plant is what we like to call the Walt Disney Studios postgraduate division. At the studio, craftsmen create in 1 and 2 dimensions for film to be projected on screen, but at WED, the craftsmen work in 3 dimensions in figures and props." So he's talking about kind of how cool Walt Disney Imagineering had become. And this was also simultaneously the time when people at Walt Disney Animation, which had been the big deal at Disney up until this point, kind of started getting a little iffy about Imagineering. And they started to kind of, when Walt Disney would walk out of the room, they'd call it Cannibal Island, because he came and he'd take like the best animators from the animation department and pull them over to WED so they would be working on Disneyland. So finishing up like this quote from this column, Armand, he said, "Final versions of everything with the WED trademark must be Disney perfect." So explained Mark Davis, who we've heard of before. He said, "The Imagineers are well aware of their responsibility to come up with the absolute best solution for any given task. So the idea that Walt Disney would use these audio-animatronics in attractions from that point forward was kind of what they were trying to market, right? And then you got Pirates of the Caribbean, Haunted Mansion, and there was also some other audio animatronic shows in there, Carousel of Progress. You can think of Bear Country Jamboree was heavily audio animatronic. You can think of America Sings. So historically, there are a lot of audio animatronic attractions that came through to Disneyland, but it all goes back to like Walt's original, like that little bird he bought in France. And then his idea to like come to his studio guys and say like, "Hey, can we make a person that does this stuff? And like, you know, when we have our attractions and our shows, we have the perfect actor that never needs to be fed or given a break or complains or anything. He just does his job perfectly every time." And that is the genesis of audio animatronics as they appear in Pirates of the Caribbean. And of course, the Haunted Mansion.
Do you love everything Disney, then tune into Mousetalgia, the podcast about Disneyland, Disney history, and Disney fandom that's been rated best by the Unofficial Guide. Whether you're looking for tips about visiting the parks or interviews with Disney celebrities, you'll find it all on the Mousetalgia podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or Player FM. And Carpe Kingdom, seize the magic.
So that's this month's episode of the Doom Buggies podcast. So I hope you like this little look at animation and kind of wandering around how it kind of ties into the genesis of the Haunted Mansion. We would love to hear from you. How can people get in touch with us, Julia?
You can find us on Instagram at Doom Buggies. You can find us on Facebook at Doom Buggies. You can find us on Twitter at Doom Buggies Web. We probably have an email address.
I think it's,
I don't know that off the top of my head.
Well, there's a bunch of them, but for the podcast, write to us at comments@doombuggies.com and that'll get to us. We even still have a toll free phone number. Mostly it's used by politicians and robocalls. Speaking of robots.
Call it.
But
call
you can use it too. It's 1-888-5-HATBOX. 1-888-5-HATBOX. And you can tell by how cool it is that I don't care if anyone ever uses it. I'm never going to give up my 1-888-5-HATBOX phone number. It's just awesome. So we would love to hear from you.
Use it.
Yes, use it. All right. So thanks for tuning in. We look forward to whatever we have to talk to you about next time around. Good talking to you this month. And without any further ado,
hurry back.
There you are. Should you decide to establish contact, please email comments@doombuggies.com or call us toll free at 1-888-5-HATBOX. On behalf of your host, I'm Emmanuel Menjivar, and we hope you will hurry back.
The Doom Buggies podcast is produced by Julia Lane and Jeff Bam and mixed by Jeff Bam. Grim Grinning Ghosts arranged and performed by Kristen Pfeiffer. Other music is performed and used courtesy of Sideshow Sound Theater. Copyright Doombuggies.com.